Have you been putting off figuring out how much money you'll need to save for retirement? Well, you're not alone. In his latest book, The Number, Lee Eisenberg looks at why so many of us avoid thinking about it and discusses how to arrive at the right number. His book is published by the Free Press, and I'm glad it has brought Lee Eisenberg to my show today. Hello.
Great to be here.
So what is the number, and how do you define it?
Well, the simplest definition is the amount of money one thinks one needs to finance the rest of one's life, obviously, presuming that you're a baby boomer or otherwise reaching the midpoint of your life. What do you need to feel secure, both from a financial point of view, but the more research I did, I began to realize that the number had an emotional component as much as a financial one.
And that's why you say that most people would rather do almost anything than talk about the number.
Yeah. In my book proposal, which I turned also into a magazine piece in Fortune a couple years ago, I referred to the number as the last taboo, and only semi-facetiously.
Because there are others, still some pretty serious taboos.
Well, not too many left. You know, I think people are far more willing to talk about the most intimate cosmetic enhancements, or certainly what's in their medicine cabinet, or erotic fantasies, or things that used to be verboten. I think they're willing to talk about that a lot faster than what they've got stashed away, or even about, you know, some of their secret hopes, dreams, fears having to do with money.
Because this is all about denial?
A lot of it is denial. A lot of it is avoidance. A lot of it is just simple fear of thinking about old age, fear of death, obviously. And I think also a lot of it has to do with a lack of security about how to think about financial matters. You know, to me it was pretty amazing to begin to think that in a society that and culture that is probably the most materialistic in the history of humankind, and certainly the most consumption-driven, money literacy is not a particular core competency.
Well, do you think we need more or less money than we think we do to live happily ever?
You've kind of jumped to the end of the book, so we're going to have to close out the interview. But yeah, no, I think that's an excellent question, and in fact, it was a question that I was.
I don't always take it in the order of the book.
Okay, no, I know, but you managed to find your way to it. The most startling discovery, and I confess that I should have thought of this a long time ago, just as a human being, but the more one examines one's life, and the more one asks questions about what do I really want to be, and what do I really want to do, and where are the unrequited, you know, desires in me, and you start figuring those questions out, it often means that you're going to require less money than you assume by not examining your life. And, you know, we walk around saying very blithely, money doesn't buy happiness, you know, duh. We all accept that, but I don't really think we live by that.
But I think most people think that retirement planning is an exercise mainly for the wealthy.
Well, once upon a time it was. In fact, financial planning is an extremely young business. It's really been only happening over the last 30 years, and not just for the wealthy. But what happened, you know, a great sea change began about 25 years ago when the old retirement support system, which I call the old rest of your life, which was basically dependent on corporate pensions and Social Security, turned into the so-called new rest of your life, which is basically this age of self-determination in which, you know, we are supposed to be the captains of our own ship and manage our own affairs. And with that change, nobody ever announced that change. Nobody said, oh, there's a brand new day here and the rest of your life is dependent on how you manage it. But nobody ever issued a press release. It just kind of seeped in on us.
But you spoke to a lot of people, and wealthy individuals seem to worry more about retirement than people who have much less. Some of them, the people you spoke to who are worth at least $1 million, told you that they were worried about their futures.
Right. Well, you know, and to them, $1 million is not a lot of money. You know, one man's $1 million is a nest egg, is another man's, you know, annual club dues.
So they're concerned they won't have enough money to allow them to live in the manner to which they become accustomed,
right,
while the rest of us are having to deal with the idea that are we going to be able to live in New York, or are we going to have to move to a place where it's cheaper to live?
Right. And even the people who have $1 million or $2 million, which is a huge amount of money in New York, In certain neighborhoods, it's nothing. And, you know, what you're bringing up is a really good question, and it has as much to do with lifestyle entitlement, a sense of lifestyle entitlement, as anything else. And, you know, the baby boomers notoriously seem to regard a certain level of lifestyle as a birthright. You know, we were always told that, you know, we were going to live better than our Depression-era parents, that anything and everything was possible. And as recently as, you know, 5 or 6 years ago, when David Brooks was writing Bobo's in Paradise, you know, the entire world was simply awash with expensive Frappuccino and Restoration Hardware and all that other stuff. And that really began to change for a great many middle and upper middle class boomers in the wake of this, you know, when the stock market started wavering, certainly post 9/11, pension funds started imploding all over the place. And now suddenly the skies are much cloudier for those people who thought they had it made.
But to some degree, it also suggests that the ones who were in denial in some ways were more realistic about what was to come. Because if you went to work for IBM, partly because you just assumed that that was going to mean a comfortable living all of your life, and then suddenly are faced in the year 2006 with no future pension from IBM, gee, you were too trusting, weren't you?
Yeah, you were certainly too trusting.
If you put money in the bank like we did when we were kids, a quarter every day. Well, the banks won't even allow you to do that anymore. But the interest rates are so low, you barely make any money on it anyway.
Well, you don't, because you know the cost of living eats that up, and so on. Well, there are the IBMers, and then even worse, there are the Enron people and the WorldCom people and the people who were so unfortunate as to lose everything, as opposed to simply having their pension funds, in the case of IBM, frozen. And at least IBM is substituting a fairly generous, I'm told, 401k plan. But the important thing is, you know, we are the ones who have to captain our own ships. And you know, whether we have a lot of money or not a lot of money, we all want a happy sunset on the horizon when we age. And the problem is nobody gave us sailing instructions, and a lot of people never even got a paddle.
My guest is Lee Eisenberg, who's written The Number, A Completely Different Way to Think About the Rest of Your Life. It's published by Free Press. This is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. There was a story in the Wall Street Journal today about new programs to encourage poor people to save in a systematic way. That has been a big problem for a lot of people. They say, well, you know, I'm going to have to rely on my Social Security because I just do not have any extra money at the end of the month.
Yeah, and the flip side of that is you've got all these tens of millions of people who have no need whatsoever for Social Security. About a year ago, when I was researching this book, I was talking to an NYU professor who is a friend of mine, and it was right when the Bush proposal was in the news. And I said, "So, how do you feel about Social Security?" And he said, "Well, frankly, you know, I've saved a lot of money, and my wife makes a lot of money, and we don't really need Social Security whatsoever in order to take care of our old age." And I said, "So, would you give it back? I mean, how do you feel about not being eligible for it?" And he said, "Hell, I'm not giving it back. I paid into it. I want it." And then there was a pause, and he said, "That's about a year's worth of wine budget in our house, and I want it." And he's a liberal. and that's one of the big issues with Social Security. A great many people, whether they need it or not, are going to get it. And, of course, that's not what Social Security was ever supposed to be, at least not initially. It was supposed to be a safety net. It was supposed to be an insurance policy. It wasn't supposed to be, in his case, a carton, you know, a case of wine.
Then there are those people who hate the thought of retiring. Is there anything wrong with continuing to work until you no longer can and hoping that you'll last long enough so that you don't have to worry about retirement?
Yeah, not only is there nothing wrong with it, I'm a great proponent of that. I fail to see the reason for retirement, particularly when you look at the way so many people use their retirements. This is obviously opinionated, but to me, retiring so that you can play golf 7 days a week is not a particularly engaging way to spend.
I don't play golf. I don't know what to do.
I wasn't accusing you of doing that. But I do think what's happening now, and maybe there's a silver lining in it, because we're living longer, because the workplace is going to need a lot of part-time workers, because people do have to manage their own affairs, because we are healthier at our age than our parents were, because there are all of these preventive and therapeutic treatments now to keep people ticking, you know, for a long time. Suddenly there's been this prolonged period of what used to be, you know, you retired at 65 and you died 3 or 4 years after, and Social Security and your pension took care of you. Now you've got this long period, much longer period, in which you need to do something. And a big part of the book is talking about the transition into that phase. You know, a lot of people call that downshifting, or, you know, it's very fashionable these days. Some researchers and academics have now taken the old retirement and sliced it into 4 or 5 baby retirement stages. It's getting to be a great specialty now among sociologists. But the fact of the matter is, there's no reason to do nothing. And in fact, you know, study after study will show that the more engaged you are, and the more involved you are, the more you indulge your own passions, in late, middle, and old age, the happier and longer lived you're going to be.
So have you always been this wise? How old were you when you started planning and putting away money for your retirement?
Old.
So you had the lost years that you talked about?
Yeah, the lost years. Well, I spent most of my career, as you mentioned at the beginning, as a magazine editor. And because if you're a magazine editor, or if you were a magazine editor in New York in the 70s and the 80s, you basically didn't have to spend any money. There were movie screenings. You know, there were always sort of discount suits available. All this was ethical, by the way. It was all, you know, legitimate. You had nice expense account lunches. You had all that stuff. So, and a lot of people who fancy themselves creative people often go into a field like journalism or become writers because they don't want to deal with the demon of money, because there's something offensive about that. I had several journalists tell me that was, consciously or otherwise, one of the reasons they went into the field, because they didn't then have to sort of fail or succeed at making money. It wasn't really part of the deal. So I was a procrastinator, as a vast majority of people were. And in fact, I was thinking the other day that in my early years as a kid editor in New York, I found it much easier to pick up the phone and call Truman Capote or Tom Wolfe or, you know, somebody and ask them to do a story than I felt when my erstwhile broker from Merrill Lynch called me and started to try to sell me some impossible to understand, you know, derivative financial product that could never go down, could only go up. And I probably spent half my working day figuring out how to avoid his phone calls, whereas almost no one else intimidated me.
Is this something that is unique to baby boomers?
Well, I think the circumstances, the larger circumstances around which we're talking, are certainly unique to baby boomers, in the sense that there are economic and financial and demographic forces at work that don't apply to any other generation. But the other thing that I think is unique here is, you know, in this immense population of people, 76 million people, there is about to be, in the words of a financial executive that I talked to, the greatest transfer of wealth in the history of the world. You know, when you think about how the baby boomers are going to have to manipulate their rollovers from their 401ks and how they choose to take and when they choose to take their Social Security, when to take their pension money, assuming they have one, their ongoing need to support their parents who are still alive and get through the college tuition of their own kids. And then all of the bequests and all of the estates that are going to start falling into play when their parents die, or when usually the males of a baby boom marriage start to die. The next 30 or 40 years is just going to be a huge amount of money rolling around. And what's intriguing about that to the financial services industry is, one, there's a lot of money to be made if you get a market share of it. But there's also some very interesting marketing challenges they have. They're going to have to start talking. They know this. They have to start talking to women a whole lot more intelligently than they ever have.
How are they going to deal with the incredibly huge debt numbers that have been accrued by people who do make a comfortable living.
That is an immense problem. There's two problems that when you ask a financial advisor who deals with upper middle class or beyond people, debt is a very important one. You know, we are way over mortgaged, and not to mention what we've got on our plastic cards. But the other really big problem is going to be inherited wealth. That, you know, we talk all the time about this extraordinary disparity of wealth that exists in the society, and certainly that's not just. But among the people who have money, there is going to be a pretty significantly broad problem when all of that money starts flowing to their kids. And the kids are generally not going to be in particularly good shape, I don't think. Emotionally, and when they start, inheriting those enormous houses and all the rest.
My guest is Lee Eisenberg, former editor-in-chief of Esquire, among other things, also developer of Rotisserie Baseball.
But, one of them. I can't claim sole credit, but I was present at the creation, yes.
And his latest book is The Number, A Completely Different Way to Think About the Rest of Your Life, from Free Press. We will continue after this. We're back with Lee Eisenberg, whose latest book is The Number, A Completely Different Way to Think About the Rest of Your Life, published by Free Press. You say in your book, an unexamined life, I'm quoting, an unexamined life may or may not be worth living, but it is almost always more costly than an examined one. So why is the unexamined life more expensive?
Well, because the things that you often find out when you examine your life tend not to be particularly expensive to have. I mean, the things that really matter. For example, if one of your great dreams is to try to write the great American novel, or if you want to give something back to the community or a church, or if you want to indulge a passion of mountain climbing, trekking, whatever that might be. Generally speaking, those things cost less than acquiring multiple houses for each season and having a boat and joining expensive country clubs and so on and so forth. So invariably, as you zero in on the things that truly matter and in fact would give you the most satisfaction, those are generally not attached to big price tags.
On the other hand, one of the investment advisors you spoke to suggested that most executives don't realize how much of their expense accounts are underwriting their lifestyles, paying for their entertainment, their travel, their club memberships, etc. And when they no longer have that available to them, they're going to have to make major sacrifices.
Yeah, well, they are. And then they enter into this, the dreaded, what I call, lifestyle relapse. I think a lot of upper middle class people obviously don't want to ever have to go backwards and make those sacrifices that you mentioned. So on a couple of occasions, I sat down with the financial advisors and tried to sort of tote up what the value. And we're not talking about the CEO's package. We're talking about senior type executives at a company who've been around for a while. And when you add up, and we're not assuming any hanky panky when it comes to using company benefits. This is all legitimate and straight. But when you add up sort of the boondoggle trade conferences that they go to, which invariably are at the Ritz-Carlton or someplace like that, when you add up the value of their expense account meals, which are always in nice restaurants with good wine.
And cab fares.
And cab fare.
And everything else.
And all the rest. And there's often a lot of companies continue to pay at least part of the retirement planning, financial planning advice that a certain executive, might get. So, that quickly adds up, and, that without breaking a sweat can come to $50,000 or $80,000 a year worth of stuff, which would then have to start coming out of the pocket of the retired executive. And to, you know, often as not, he just doesn't have that. And yet most people, when they contemplate retirement, when they're in pre-retirement, don't really think that through, and then they sort of hit the wall and they suddenly feel, you know, not only poor, but they feel less important in life, and they don't have a real passion to fill the hollowness with.
A number of people have told me that one of the things they're counting on is selling their homes and then moving to a much less expensive place.
Well,
the sale of their home will fund their retirement.
And that's legitimate, and I think a lot of them will. But that's certainly going to involve a downsize. They're going to have a smaller place, and I think people are willing to do that. But if they want to live in an equivalently nice neighborhood, they're not going to save a lot of money by doing that. Those places aren't cheap either. So I think in many cases that it's illusory and it's kind of a lateral move.
Why have you compared New York Times business writer Bob Stein to Freddy Krueger?
Ben Stein. Ben Stein writes a column every month. I think it's every month, or maybe more often, in the Sunday Business section of the Times. And as I was researching the book, I was reading one of them. And he wrote what I thought was a really terrifyingly scary and perhaps overly scary piece about what it costs to live in New York. And he talked about, I forget the exact details, but he was talking about a 50-something-year-old woman who had a six-figure income, but by no means was, you know, Warren Buffett and so on. And he projected out that she would need, and I may be getting the numbers wrong, something like $4 million in invested assets if she was going to keep her lifestyle over a specific period of time. What I objected to
I should be so lucky.
what I objected to, and that's not an uncommon kind of story. You read those pieces in the paper all the time. But what's missing from a story like that is that there were any number of really important facts about the woman that we weren't told. We didn't know whether she had too many dependents or any dependents. We weren't told what her passions might be. It may be that she would be very content to live, as you mentioned before, in a smaller place and write haiku or do whatever. We didn't know about the state of her health. So what I was saying more than anything is there's so much now being written about this, but it's all on a very superficial level, and you can't apply a formulaic approach to what somebody needs to everyone. And yet, you know, much of what's written about personal finance is that. And my book, for better or worse, is not an advice book. It is a book, really, that tries more to get at why people don't take advice or may not know good advice when they hear it.
But you do seem to have a lot of respect for someone who does give advice, George Kinder.
Well, George Kinder, to me, is an extraordinary man. I don't know if you've had him on or know him, but George Kinder is a financial planner who likes to call himself a life planner, which is a term that I don't like. It sort of sounds to me like a Yentin great neck who takes you shopping and manages to clean up your closet and all the rest. But George Kinder believes that you cannot do any sort of intelligent financial plan until you do figure out what really matters to you. Last year, I took a very intense workshop that he gave. It was myself and 90 financial planners in the basement of a hotel in Denver, Colorado. And he puts us through. I was very, very skeptical about a lot of this touchy-feely kind of financial planning. But he put us all through some pretty amazing exercises that were designed to get these planners to be much, much more empathetic, to be better listeners when they sat down with a client, because I don't have to tell you, most financial planners or financial consultants are not necessarily trained to be good listeners or to be empathetic, nor should they be, because it would be very dangerous if they started mucking around with our psyches. And he knows that. But the last exercise that he gave was this sort of three big question exercise that I won't get into in great detail. But the last question was and he posed a hypothetical situation, you go to a doctor and the doctor closes the door and says, I've got really bad news for you. You've got a very rare and incurable disease and you will die in the next 24 hours. And then Kinder says, I want everybody in the room now to stop and think and write down, what did you not get to do? You know, who did you not get to be? Now, that may sound very morbid, but it's actually very inspiring when you think about it, because if you can answer that question, Kinder will say it is the answer to that question around which you build your financial plan in order to realize that unrequited, whatever that might be. And you know, it may sound obvious on one level, but it's amazing how few people seem to talk to themselves that way.
But for somebody who has never earned a lot of money, is a financial planner even something that I should consider?
Yeah, absolutely. The problem is finding one you can trust who you can afford. You know, as I've said over and over again, I guess, this new rest of your life is immensely complicated. There are, you know, it is hugely complicated to know how to apportion your assets. It's very complicated to even figure out, should I start taking Social Security at 62 or 65?
Or later.
Or later, exactly. And any number of other things. You know, tax laws are being changed continuously. And the fact of the matter is we don't have an easy, ready, or in many cases trustworthy source to tell us what to do. And if you rely on the brokerage house for it, or the place where you keep your, you know, whatever, your mutual funds, you really have to understand that the you know, man or woman who calls you to suggest something may be working on a commission. Most people aren't clear about that. It's very opaque. But that does not obviate the need for sound advice. There is something interesting happening, and I don't know if this will be the solution or not, but there are a number of startup operations around the country that are trying to basically bring a kind of an H&R Block approach. As H&R Block is to tax planning, they are trying almost to bring a storefront financial retirement planning service to everyday people, where you basically pay for what you need. And if you're confused, if you're ready to retire and you're not wealthy, but you want to know at least how to set things up, you go in, much as you're going for a dental cleaning, and you will pay by the hour. There's nothing sold. There are no commissions. There's no pressure. And you will get a financial plan. And then if you need to go back twice a year or three times a year or once a year just to check up on it, you can do that. And I'm almost certain that some kind of industry like that is about to start growing across the country.
There are added problems. People's retirement plans are sometimes changed by unexpected life events, the death of a spouse or a divorce, a job loss, a drop in the stock market. People who thought that they were very comfortably set 15 years ago suddenly found themselves losing lots of money, and the market has never really recovered for them.
Right. Well, it's called stuff happens. Actually, it's called something worse than that, but you know, it's called life. Who
and
knows?
Then healthcare costs are going up, and you might suddenly have this illness, and that drains all of your life savings.
Absolutely. Fidelity Investments said that if you are a relatively healthy, I think it was a 55 or 60-year-old, you would be well advised to set aside a couple $100,000 simply for unexpected catastrophic healthcare costs.
I could.
Oh, yes. And I'm forgetting exactly the specific number right now, but a remarkably large number of people of all income levels spend some time in a nursing home over the course of their lives. And obviously insurance will pay for some of them and not pay for others. And we have to have part of our kitty set aside for, you know, terrible things like that.
Over the years, we've had guests on the show who predicted that the Social Security system will go bust before the baby boomers can collect. Others say that's just hogwash. But how much should we rely on Social Security, even if everything works perfectly fine?
Well, I personally don't know. I can tell you what people who think about it a lot tell me, although there's no real consensus. Those financial advisors who have somewhat younger clients, and there are not many younger clients who look for financial advice, but they tell me that people in their 20s and 30s are basically not counting on Social Security being there. They're just assuming it's not going to be there, and if it will, it will not be of material difference to their lives. You know, beyond that, I think it's anybody's guess. I tend to come down on the side of, you know, the Paul Krugmans of the world and others who believe that with tweaking, you know, with some subtle turning of the dials, we can keep that system pretty much intact the way it's been.
If you've worked it out for yourself, aren't you pretty much set? You've written books on finding the good life through golf and fishing. You're one of the developers of rotisserie baseball.
You can right. probably well, keep yourself I have very to tell you, busy. Writing books, in case none of your guests has ever told you this before, writing books, even books that sell, or inventing fantasy baseball is not a straight shot at a big, fat, healthy number.
I was worried about that because I looked on Amazon.com yesterday. You were ranked 38, this book was. This morning it went down to 65, and I was wondering how much are you thinking about that when you think about what's going to happen in the next few years?
Well, first of all, I'm totally pleased as punch to be 65. It's hard to be 65. And after this interview with you, of course, I'll be back up in the top 10 since everybody in your audience reads and buys books. You know, I would never recommend writing as a career to anybody who wanted to guarantee a healthy, successful second half. That's not what you do to do that. So for me, at you know, my, this point in my life, having worked at companies and not been a writer my entire life, I feel at least I have the luxury of the time to be able to do a good book over a couple of years.
Has retirement planning changed the way you think about flossing your teeth?
Not really. The reference, if people don't know it, is they're you know, in one of the myriad books, and billions of books that are published all the time about how to live longer, let alone how to not to die rich or die poor, you know, whatever else. There have been several books that have recommended flossing as a significant step toward greater longevity, because getting rid of the certain bacteria in your mouth that could possibly migrate their way to, you know, your aorta or wherever else bacteria like to go has been, at least in some studies, proven to be an extension of one's life.
So has working on this book changed your life? I'm sure you're flossing now.
Actually, I'm not. Don't tell my dentist. I do floss, but I don't floss maniacally. If I actually believed the longevity thing, I would be sitting here flossing in the studio, which I assure the listeners I am not. It's caused me to think more about what I said a while ago is the sort of the probing part. I mean, having been through the lost years and having been a financial idiot most of my life about how money works, I now think I have a basic working understanding of, you know, why the price of a bond goes up when inflation goes down and vice versa. I didn't know much of that stuff. So I do know that, and I feel relatively confident that I know as much as at least your average stockbroker. But this whole probing part, you know, the question of, you know, should I be giving something back to something that I've been too, you know, greedy not to give back to yet? When and how can I start working my way to that?
Lee Eisenberg will be reading and signing books tonight at 7 p.m. at the Upper West Side Barnes & Noble store. That's on Broadway and 82nd Street. Tomorrow he will be at the Borders Books and Music Store at 100 Broadway near Wall Street at 12:30 p.m. His book, The Number, is published by Free Press. Thank you so much for being with
us
today.
Great. Thank you.
On tomorrow's show, the struggles of Jews of color throughout Asia, Africa, and Latin America to maintain the religion and culture of their ancestors. Plus, Gail Sheehy explores how modern society is changing the romantic lives of middle-aged women, a look at the positive impact of baby boomers on America, and the highly sexualized work of Viennese artist Egon Schiele. The Leonard LoPage Show is produced by Melissa Egan with Sarah English and Brenna Farrell. We had help today from Isha Sabatini-Sloan and Virginia Doris. Bill O'Neill was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard LoPage, your host. I'll see you tomorrow.